I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for coming along to the Sydney Writers Festival this afternoon. My name is Sally Rugg, and we're going to have a really great panel today deciding once and for all who is the ultimate Faruqi. It's funny that the event title is Faruqi on Faruqi, because I think it's probably, it's like a little bit rug on Faruqi.
Yeah, totally.
But then that's like, as if you're sort of cuddled up with a blanket. Anyway, Faruqi on Faruqi is going to work. We are gathered here today on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And today and every day, everywhere we move through this expansive land, we must remember that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded. And we are on and always will be on Aboriginal land. I pay my respects to any elders past and present who are here, and elders past and present of the Eora Nation. And I was really struck, I don't know if many people were at the opening address on Tuesday night, Auntie Anne Weldon, who's a Wiradjuri elder and the director of the Sydney Metropolitan Land Council, did a welcome to country, which is, you know, my acknowledgement is just like a, you know, poor imitation. But I was struck in that moment, her, Auntie Anne's, like, generous, moving welcome to the Eora Nation. At just what an incredibly beautiful part of First Nations culture welcoming to country is, and how, like, I don't know if we necessarily always afford the same grace and welcome to the First Nations people who sort of show up and welcome us to country time and time again. What a beautiful cultural tradition that we all get to share and appreciate. So I just wanted to mention that. Osman Faruqi is the editor of Schwartz Media's daily news podcast, 7am. Who listens to 7am? Oh, all of you. Fantastic.
Thank you. The ones that don't should, please listen to Faruqi.
He has worked as an editor at the ABC and was an award-winning reporter with the flagship audio documentary program Background Briefing. He's judged the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards and is writing a book on race in Australia with Penguin Random House. Title, TBC. That's not what
TBC is not about, we can work backwards from that. As
yeah. Everyone, please welcome Oz. Dr. Maureen Faruqi is the Green Senator for New South Wales. She's a civil and environmental engineer and lifelong activist for social and environmental justice. In 2013, she joined New South Wales State Parliament, becoming the first Muslim woman to sit in an Australian Parliament. In 2018, Maureen became Australia's first Muslim senator. She's been a passionate advocate against racism and misogyny. Since joining the federal Senate, Maureen has been an outspoken advocate for public education, social housing, and animal welfare. She continued her work calling out discrimination in her first speech, condemning the legitimization, normalization, and encouragement of hate in politics and the media. She's the Australian Green spokesperson for education and lifelong learning, housing, animal welfare, local government, gun control and industry. Gosh, they keep you busy.
They do.
And her book, which will be out in July, and you can sign it and then the Senator will sign it, is called Too Migrant, Too Muslim, Too Loud by Alan and Unwin. Please welcome.
And I beat Oz to it. But who's competing?
And I would like to wish you both Ramadan Mubarak and Ramadan Mubarak to anybody in the audience who is also observing. So, Oz, I think we all want to know, what was it like being born to... what was it like being born to the right and honourable Dr. Senator Maureen Faruqi?
Really good question. I'm normally not really nervous in front of people at these sorts of things, but this one has freaked me out a little bit, I think. Yeah. And just when you asked that question, it all really hit me, because normally I'm just talking about how dumb politicians are or how racist the media is. And now I'm getting very personal with my mum, with a lot of people I know, which is going to be a lot of fun. I feel like all the things that I've tried to like hide from, everyone here is going to be able to call me out now, I think. A few people ask me this and they're like, you know, you're obviously very politically engaged and you work in the media and your mum's a senator, and obviously that must have been, you must have learnt so much like at her knee. And I mean, I learnt an enormous amount from mum and owe everything in my life really to her, but mum's kind of foray into politics kind of happened at the latter part of your career. And it's not to say I don't think that mum wasn't like political and we didn't talk about politics and justice, and obviously we did, and that's how I shaped so many of my views. But I think people are often surprised that for most of my life, my entire like childhood and even to my adult life, you were an engineer, you were working in consultancy, you're working in local government, you became an academic. And then it was after like I was sort of, you know, adulted and learnt and went out that you became a politician. And it's, yeah, I think people are often thrown when they hear that because they just assumed that I grew up sort of watching you do all this political stuff.
So you didn't indoctrinate Oz into like radical left extremism from infancy. It was a little later. But surely you would have, you know, instilled some sort of values.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I might start at the very beginning then. And hello, everyone. It is absolutely lovely to be here with all of you in this space after the year we've all had. And Oz, I'm sorry that I'm revealing some things, but nothing personal. Uh-oh. Nothing personal, mate.
Jesus.
So when I got pregnant with Oz... I'll start this like I said at the very beginning.
This is the opposite of the Daniel Kaluuya Oscars thing.
Yeah. Please just...
I mean, shout out to my mum and dad for having sex, I guess. And putting me there.
Well, let's start from the moment you realised you were pregnant. We'll start
yes,
from that.
Exactly. Yeah. The one thought in my mind was, I desperately want a daughter. Truly. And there were a few reasons for that. I guess, you know, in Pakistan, you know, there is this tradition where people revere sons, and you know, the firstborn should be a son. And it, throughout my pregnancy, when I would see my grandfather quite a bit, who lived next door to us, and every time he would say that he was praying that I would have a son, and I would have to tell him to change his prayers every time and pray for a daughter, and that didn't happen. And then came you know, the delivery stage, and it was, even despite my mother saying, no, it's all fine, I've had four kids, you don't need to worry about painkillers or anything, it was desperately painful. And through this pain, I'm thinking, please let it be a daughter, because I can't do this again. I cannot do this again. And then came this wonderful human, this amazing son of mine, and I have to say this, who is warm-hearted and generous, and has such an amazing moral compass. And, you know, is feminist as fuck, frankly. He is. He really is. And I was talking to my husband this morning and thinking of, you know, how did Oz become Oz? And, you know, do you remember, I want to relate some incidents about him when, you know, we used to talk about social justice and debate things and radical stuff. And he said, how many incidents do you want me to tell you? He was always arguing and debating and questioning things. And I'll just relate maybe a couple of those incidences.
Yeah, keep
like
embarrassing
one, me. One
yeah,
of his, yeah. Yeah. I'll start with the good ones. One of his generosity. We were big on birthday parties for children. So when we started these big birthday parties, probably when you were in kindy, and I said, okay, Oz, who do you want to invite? And Oz's response always was, well, I can't leave anyone out, Mum. So the whole class would always come to Oz's birthday parties.
Well, people that go out with me now know that's still the vibe.
Yeah. And he was very young, quite young, I think probably 10 or 11, when Omar and I, that's my husband, we were having a chat once about engineering and, you know, pays for engineers and pays for, you know, the construction workers who, you know, take up the shovel and do the real work, and the difference in those pays. And Oz piped up and goes, well, why do you think there should be a difference in pays? Why should engineers get more money than the person digging up the site?
Good question.
They work harder than engineers. Like, he totally stumped us by saying, well, why do you think after having been to university, you should be the ones to get higher pays. So I think at a very early age, Oz really had that amazing
Yeah, I was indoctrinating her in leftist propaganda.
Yeah, well, exactly right. Yeah, yeah. I think that is actually true. It was both ways. It really was. And I did drag Oz when he was 14, and I joined the Greens in Port Macquarie at that time. I was too scared to do it on my own, so I dragged Oz with me, and we both became members at that time. I know you're not a member anymore, but yeah. I'm still here.
At 14, all I wanted to do was surf and, you know, hang out with girls, and I was going to Greens branch meetings with 75-year-olds. Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah, yeah.
You've gone, but those 75-year-olds are still there.
When you started telling that anecdote about wanting a boy so desperately, because backstage you were like, oh, I'm going to roast my son. I thought where that was going was like, and I was disappointed in him from the moment he was born. So it was quite nice to hear that that was not working.
And you did get like, well, I have a sister. She's great. You got a daughter as well.
Parent-teacher meetings were not that great, though, I have to say. So we like my husband and I would dread those parent-teacher meetings a bit because, you know, we sat down with the teacher and they said, oh, he's very clever, all of that. And there was always a but, and we would always dread that but. So in year one, the but was he finishes his work very quickly and then he just doesn't sit at his desk. He crawls under desks to say hello to his friends. So he was a troublemaker.
You still do that, right?
Before. I still do that.
You still do that at the 7 a.m.
At dinners, yeah, that's what I do. Yeah.
And so, and what were your childhood memories like? Was it, what if a child from your class, you know, comes to your birthday party, everyone's there.
Yeah.
Or and then sort of stays for the afternoon. What's it like in the Faruqi household?
Well, I think this is Mum said so many nice things about me, and I just don't think that, you know, as many descriptions and adjectives I could use today, I'm never going to be able to encapsulate like how wonderful it is to be raised and to still have you as my mum. But I feel like what I was so lucky growing up because we had a lot of fun, like you and Dad, your parents. And I think it's, you know, there's so many like stereotypes about what it's like to grow up with like migrant parents and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, to me, the kind of relationship to our country, Pakistan, and the culture you instilled me with is a hugely important part of who I am, and I think the values that I have. But also, I got that component, but then we also just had, like, my friends loved coming over because they loved hanging out with you guys. And yeah, we got to do a lot of fun stuff together, and we still do.
The board games at night.
Yeah.
It was amazing. We always had visitors coming in and out. That's a Pakistani tradition. I kept going because my mother always told me you need room in your heart, not in your home. And so it was great. People visiting from overseas, friends staying overnight.
Yeah, the one sort of like ethnic mum, there's two ethnic mum stereotypes probably that you really live up to. And the first is like, even though I've lived out of home now for a while, every time I visit, I feel like, when are you moving back? And even and even this week, I'm visiting from Melbourne for the Writers' Fest. And actually, this reflects badly on me, I think, because everyone's assuming...
As it should.
Everyone's assuming that you must be staying with your parents, right? And I'm like, oh, true, I haven't seen you in 6 months. But I was like, the Writers' Festival's put me up in a really nice hotel in the middle of the city. It's very fun.
Who does that? Really?
Why don't you invite your mum to the hotel? Give mum a nice experience. Okay.
That's probably a good reason for that.
The people who've seen me around the hotel the last couple of days know the reasons for that.
Okay, okay. And so you're both, you know, quite extraordinary change makers and communicators in different ways and also some quite similar ways. But is this like a Faruqi thing? Do you come from a long line of, you know, leaders and change makers and communicators? Or, you know, is this a...
Mum knows the history better than me.
I guess Pakistan is a place which is very different to Australia in the sense, and that it struck me when I came here, that people were not very open talking about politics. Whereas in Pakistan, you know, everyone talks about politics. You know, from the person who sells the samosa on the street to the beautician you go to have your eyebrows threaded to, you know, everyone. So at home, every night, and we don't have dinner just on our own every night. There's someone always, a guest is always present at dinner. There were massive debates. That's what I remember about my childhood. Massive debates about what's happening in politics. And one of my aunts really is the person who you know, made me who I am. She was a radical feminist in Pakistan, and you know, she just was loud and outspoken and the lone voice in at most of the times. So you know, I'm very proud to say that I was made in Pakistan, and obviously when I moved here, you know, I've kind of honed my campaigning and, you know, political skills, and that happened very quickly as well. So we came here in 1992. And the perception that I had of countries like Australia, you know, the first world countries compared to the third world country that I grew up in, was that, you know, equality had been reached in every way. And, you know, I was expecting that society. And initially I did. For a few months I thought, no, Australia had worked quite hard for egalitarianism. But we didn't get any jobs. My husband and I, both engineers, no one would give us a look in because we didn't have local experience. We were on the dole. And then suddenly realized the stigma that people on welfare have, you know, the whole dole bludger attitude. And I think those were really formative for me in Australia, those kinds of things. But I think what's in our blood is engineering. And Oz, that's where you have disappointed us. My dad was an engineer. I'm an engineer. My husband's an engineer. His dad was an engineer. My three brothers and sisters are engineers. My daughter is an engineer. So here we have a journalist.
When I was figuring out what to study at university, I remember talking to you and dad, and I really like, you know, I really like reading and I like writing. I was like, I want to study arts, and I vividly remember you and dad saying like, if you want to just read a book, you know, like you go to university to learn something practical. Don't waste your time. And I did. I enrolled in engineering,
yeah.
And I failed maths in my first year, and I had to spend summer while everyone else was having fun doing remedial maths in my first summer. And I should have realized then and there that this was not for me. But it's a lot of pressure, as you can imagine. That speech is something I hear every single night. And then even I feel like when I decided to do media and became a journalist, it wasn't actually until a few years ago when I started working at the ABC that mum and dad were proud, because at least that was like a public sector job, which is something that means a lot to, I think, migrant parents.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, I guess I have to be fair as well and say, like, I went from a most trusted profession of engineering to the least trusted profession now of a politician. So, you know. I'm in the similar boat
as you are. Totally.
I want to talk about theories of change. And so in campaigning... Oh, I just forgot to introduce myself. Sorry. So I'm a campaigner. There you go. And my name is Sally Rugg. So in campaigning, there is a sort of concept called theories of change, and it's sort of like... the theory of change behind a petition might be like, if 100,000 people sign this petition, then when we deliver it, you know, this decision maker will take notice. Or, you know, a march on the street might be like, you know, if we stop traffic for the whole morning in peak time with our big banners, then our message will get in the media. So you see what I mean? This theories of change. And I wanted to talk about the theory of change that sits within and through, like, legislative reform, like making change from within. So using the systems that we already have in place, in this instance, like the Westminster democratic system. And so this clearly hasn't always been your theory of change, Senator. What made you... join that Greens meeting back in Port Macquarie, and then what made you think, actually, I think this is my theory of change?
Yeah, I think that making the change from within is that eternal question of, you know, can you dismantle the master's house using the master's tools, right? So my kind of journey through politics was very organic, to be really frank. So, you know, when you're a migrant, it takes you a very long time to just find your feet in a new country, to find jobs, to, you know, kids in school, all of that. So it took me a good 10 years before I could even think of getting involved in the community, you know, apart from the usual kids' schools and other things. And it was in Port Macquarie that I actually got that time where we had deliberately moved to be kind of spend more time with family in smaller places. And that's where I met a few people in the refugee movement, in the environment movement. And as the story goes, I was sitting in our place at dinner once. We had six or seven friends, and it turned out that was the Greens contingent in Port Macquarie. So I just thought, okay, this is a good place to start, you know, contributing to the community, the society. And I love my engineering. I really am I'm a tragic in terms of engineering. I never even crossed my mind that I ever wanted to be a politician. But one thing led to the other, and it happened. And, you know, I, even now when I'm there, it is an internal tension within me, because I feel that change much better happens from outside parliaments. So that tension that I'm in a place which is a sexist, racist, patriarchal institution, and here I am trying to do my best to build an anti-racist, a feminist nation. So there is that eternal tension. But from my perspective, I'm trying to use the platform and the privilege I have as an MP to mostly work with the community and make sure that my resources and, you know, whatever capacity I have can be used with the building campaigning outside, because I have seen that change comes only when the politicians know that their communities want that change. And one good example of that is abortion law reform in New South Wales. The politicians were dragged to it once it became inevitable, and they knew that they couldn't get away within their communities without doing that change. And so some of them might claim that they were the ones who made that change, but it wasn't. It was the people outside who made that change. And exactly the same thing with marriage equality. The ones who claim, or ones who think, like they did put the legislation up, but they're not the ones who actually made that change. So I feel that you have to, obviously, you have to dismantle the master's house, but you have to do it with tools that are different to the ones that are used in there, which are tools of aggression and bullying and sexism. So, you know, and I made a deliberate choice to not shout across the chamber and use those same aggressive tactics when you're in there. So I think I'm trying. It's hard. I'm still an outsider. I've always been an outsider in politics, but I believe that there should be more outsiders there. You know, we don't need more white men. We don't need more political staffers. We don't need, you know, people who have just done politics all their lives. We need more women, we need more First Nations people, we need more diversity in there. So we need to change the people, and we need to change the system which puts up laws as the one we saw at midnight last night, where they're going to jail people, you know, having the threat of jail hanging on top of people's heads if they try and come out of India. Australians who have a right to be here face that threat. I mean, where's the outrage? Why aren't we out there on the streets screaming and shouting and ranting and raving? It's just because it's become so normalized. Racism in our country has become so normalized that we just think it's bad and we move on.
I really wanted to call you a bourgeois sellout, but that was a really good speech, so I can't do that now. Sally really underplayed her. She's described herself as a campaigner, but Sally is the head of change.org, you know, big campaigning website, and ran the marriage equality campaign for Get Up. As much as like we're talking about this stuff, it's also someone you should listen to if you get the opportunity to talk about theories of change. Because I think when you brought up marriage equality, I think that is such a this is annoying because I actually really wanted to argue with you about this, but everything you said I agree with. Because I think there was a time where I once thought maybe I would want to get involved in federal politics, but my experience in politics, my experience in media made me realize that ultimately the people making those decisions, and I mean, I guess this does also include you, they're the last place that the change actually occurs. Like, it's almost like that's the final thing, that those guys get dragged kicking and screaming by the rest of society.
No, I don't
to
agree
do
with that.
Okay, we're going to fight now. All right.
Yes.
All right, do it.
Well, you included me in that, and I don't think I belong to that.
No. I just mean, you're in parliament, you're a senator.
Yeah.
You obviously do really good work with the community. That's the model that I think politics should operate within, is like, using the resources and profile you have to build the movements outside. I think there's too many politicians, and I think, with respect, I think too many Greens politicians as well, who think that their job is to be really smart in Parliament, to like come up with tricky little committee processes and try and like get the right story on the front page of the newspaper as a way to put leverage on the government to do things. I think all those tactics have a role to play, but I think one of the frustrating things is being seen, even like the left in Australia, becomes so captured by process and by sucking up to the media and by sucking up to political figures. And that's part of the reason I think politics in Australia is in a malaise right now. There is much less, even throughout Australian history, there's been much bigger social movements that have really led and driven change. And I think there's a sense that progress is inevitable. My feeling from the last few decades is we are worse now. Like, you talk about the India travel ban, people I saw on Twitter are saying, oh, this reminds me of the White Australia policy. The White Australia policy never did this. There was never a point during White Australia that Australian citizens were jailed if they tried to come to Australia. This is
worse. They were all white at that time, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point, right? Like, we have done things to Australian citizens and because of their skin colour that were never done during the worst periods of racial politics in Australia. And I think it's kind of it terrifies me a lot, because I think we're getting worse before we're getting better.
I mean, I agree with you to the extent, I guess, that, you know, this tent that we're in as politicians is a very seductive place. We know that power seduces everyone, and, you know, and Greens are also politicians. But I think it's not easy as well to try and dismantle a system from within. So, you know, we try. We're not there yet, obviously. But I do envy I do envy you for one thing, which is that, you know, like, I don't have, yeah, for one thing.
One thing.
Many things, but one thing now. You know, like, I don't have probably the freedom to speak my mind at all times. You know, I am kind of representative of my membership within the Greens, and I might not always agree, you know, with what the members might decide. So, you know, you can have a private chat to me about private schools, perhaps, or militarization, or, you know, the need for jails, and I might give you a different answer to what our membership might give you. So, and I sometimes am very frustrated when, you know, something, a news breaks, and we're just thinking, okay, well, we need to say something, and we have to do all the risk management, and what the party thinks, and what the members think, and by the time we get there in 2 hours or 3 hours, Oz has already said what I wanted to say. So I think there is, but obviously, you know, as envious as I am, I'm also proud that you have the guts to say what many people won't say. So it's all, I think it's all of this that comes together to make that change where we can dismantle and bring down those systems.
Just picking up, Senator, what you were saying around, you know, it's the grassroots movement that did this. You gave the example of abortion rights, and then the politicians take credit. And it's just, it's funny you mention that, because that is such a like bittersweet part of winning a campaign, is because when you're campaigning, you have to make the thing you're fighting for, if it's a political campaign, like, so politically costly if it's not acted upon, but then if it is acted upon, like, so politically beneficial. So it's like, it's stick and carrot campaigning. And so with same-sex marriage, for instance, like, you had to prove electoral benefit. And so, of course, by the time it was legislated, it was so popular that, you know, Malcolm Turnbull wanted to sort of pave over the work of tens of thousands of people to run a victory lap with the Liberal Party flag. It's the worst part of winning a campaign is watching politicians not involved.
You keep telling yourself it's the outcome. It's the outcome we're, you know, looking for. It doesn't matter who gets credit, but it's still frustrating as to who gets credit.
I want to talk about outcome and what compromises sometimes need to be made along the way. But first, Oz, I want to ask you, so we're going to come back to that. But first, I mean, you haven't said in as few words, sort of like, we should knock down Parliament House and rebuild in a sort of like restorative anarchy. But is that what you believe? Or
I'm with you. I think we don't need to rebuild it. Just knock it down.
I
don't know. I mean,
I'm asking you of sort of reform versus revolution.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I like grapple with these questions a lot. Like, I have worked in federal parliament, I've worked in state parliament, I've been part of that process of trying to change things from within as well. And ultimately, what sort of motivates the journalism that I do is this idea of, well, yes, you can change things through formal institutions, but what can be as powerful or even more powerful is changing the minds of just regular people who are even in a system with such a democratic deficit as the one that we operate in. Not everything needs to be done or achieved through official politics. So politicians pass laws that impact many people's lives, but also the way that we talk to each other, the way that we live lives, the things that we prioritize, the issues that we get passionate about, are all things that we have some agency of. And I think I've become much more passionate about those conversations than I have about trying to influence federal political outcomes. And I think that's kind of a way for me to personally sidestep this bigger question of, if you were in charge, what are the five things you would do? I kind of have grappled with that for so long, I don't really know. I think my politics are a bit more radical now than just thinking about elections, but I actually am finding way more energy and interest in talking about how we as communities can just do things differently without having to worry about politics.
Let's stick with this for a second. We'll come back to the... Or maybe we won't. Let's see. Let's stick with this. So in terms of sort of like communications in the public spheres, you know, whether it's online or at talking festivals like this or in the media or this sort of thing, like how important is the language and the frames that are used in those public conversations, and by whom?
Yeah, I think they're super important. Like, I think a huge part of what I see myself doing is trying to like expose people to ideas that are confronting, because that's ultimately how you change the narrative, I think. And I think I'm like, this is what I do. I'm not trying to say that I'm some genius who's figured it out. A lot of other people are doing it. But I think why I sometimes find myself arguing with people a lot, often people, when they meet me for the first time, they'll say like, oh, like your Twitter's pretty intense, right? Or people will say to me, I love some of the shit you do and I fucking hate some of the shit you do. And I find that like a bit weird. Just like, say hello, mate, relax. But I don't mind it either, because it's like, how boring would it be if you were just someone who everything you said was predictable and everyone already agreed and you weren't making people think about things? And I find it, the best things I ever hear from people is like, you can work really hard and you can write stories, you can tell stories, you can go on TV and do all these things. And if every 6 months one person messages you or runs into you and says, thanks for talking about this thing in the way you did, I'd never thought about that before. And in fact, I had this other view, but the way you put it helped me understand that maybe Australia's policy response on COVID is actually driven by race. Maybe there's components there. That makes all this shit, I think, a little bit worthwhile.
It really does, but it works the other way as well. Like, we know how the narrative on asylum seekers and refugees, for instance, have been used for 2 decades now by the Murdoch media, by governments of both persuasions, to demonize and dehumanize asylum seekers, you know, queue jumpers, boat people, you know, throwing kids overboard, and the whole, you know, threat to national security. And it has basically normalized how people view asylum seekers. So you're absolutely right. I mean, words do mean things. Words are very powerful. I mean, look at the place that I work in. One word I'll mention first up is the Senate. And I found out just recently what the Senate means. It's from a Latin word which means old man. I mean, I think we should change the name of that chamber for one.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But, you know, in that old man's place, you're allowed to be a racist, but you're not allowed to call out a racist. You know, you're okay to call for the final solution, but you're not okay to use the word shit. It is really, really disconcerting that this is, you know, our systems of politics. But I think words alone as well, and events like this and other things, are not the only way to change things as well. Like, you know, you can't just come to an event like this, or you can't just use whatever that recycled toilet paper is, don't give a crap.
Or who gives a crap?
Who gives a crap? That's right. And listen to 7 a.m. podcast every day and think you've done your bit. We need to do a...
I don't know why you're ragging on me.
I'm here to roast you, us. But you need to do much more than that. So words are important, but actions are even more so.
Can I? Do you mind if I say one
Please.
More thing on this?
It's your show.
Just you. Yeah, you brought up like racism in the parliament, and the other thing. I mean, if you're here and you know my work, obviously a lot of it is focused on race and racism. It's the book that I'm writing at the moment. And another thing that I often get told by people, and you'd be surprised, not just people who disagree with me or on the conservative side, a lot of progressives as well, is you really talk a lot about race, you know. You make every issue about race. And I'm with you a lot of the time. Australia's got race problems, but not everything's about race. And I find that so interesting because, one, I do it deliberately because, let's be honest, a lot of shit is about race. And when people say, you're making it about race, it's like, I think what people don't understand, and I think this goes to this issue of framing and who's been allowed to control the narrative for so long, I'm not making it about race. You made it about race. Like white people made it about, white people created the construct of race as a way to create hierarchies and exert power. But that has never been explained in a way. People like us have never had the profiles. Sorry, I shouldn't say never. There's been, particularly in this country, you know, since day one, there's been very, very, very strong and amazing Aboriginal people pushing back against the construct of what the Australian nation state is about. But when it comes to access to platforms, and it's been dominated by a particular kind of person for so long. And I think that's why it's so confronting when you start talking about these issues and people have never really heard them with that level of intensity and regularity before, I think. And so again, even though it's frustrating to hear that stuff, it sort of makes me want to do it more. And ultimately, I want to do it to the point where, like, where it shouldn't be. Like, hopefully, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, right? Because I feel like you and Dad have sometimes talked about the things that you did so that I could do certain things, right? Like, I think about, you know, I'm the age now that you guys were when you came here. And, you know, you're on the dole. You were living in an apartment that was tiny. Dad drove taxis for years. And to be honest, I think, like, there's no fucking way I'd do that, you know? If I had a kid, I'm having a good time here. I'm not moving to another country and driving cabs to look after my kid. But I do think that as I get older, I start to think, what am I doing so that my next generation has a better time than I had? And how conscious were you of that stuff when you were...
Very conscious. I mean, part of moving to Australia was this idea, because at that time, Pakistan was becoming very corrupt. It was basically entrenched. Corruption was entrenched in everything that happened in Pakistan at that time. I think it's probably improved a little bit since then. But, you know, you needed to have your passport made. You had to pay someone, or you had to know someone in the right place through the whole system. And we had grown up with very strong, like my dad had no gray areas where integrity was concerned. It was very black and white. You know, you were honest or you were not. And so we saw that slipping away, and we didn't want... We only had a son then. Now we have a daughter as well. We didn't want...
They know that. You've said that a lot.
We didn't want our kids to, you know, to continuously battle that value system when they started going to school and to work. Little did we know that we'd be doing the same in Australia. Corruption is not to that level, but we know corruption in politics is really undermining our democracy at the moment. So absolutely. And I think one of the things that drives me, I have to say, to be in the place that I am, to hopefully open the door a little bit more for people like me to make that same journey that I have made. I cannot tell you how many young women I come across, young women of color from South Asia, Muslim young women, who say that they had seen no one like them in parliament till I got there. And they feel now that they could possibly do this, that it has become a little bit easier. So if that's the only thing I've done, I think that'll be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In about 5 minutes, I'm going to ask those of you who have questions to raise your hand. And before we do that, I'd like to ask you about each of your books, which I understand are in various stages of completion. Oz, why did you want to write the book you're writing about race?
It's a really great question, because I've been thinking about it a lot. And part of the reason why it's so late, sorry, Meredith, my publisher, is I kind of have spent a lot of time grappling with how much, like, in some ways it makes sense that the first book that I write would be about race in Australia. It's something that I've thought and done a lot of thinking and a lot of work on. But then there's also this element of me that thinks, but you know, there's so many other things I want to talk about as well that have nothing to do with this. Like, I got my start in journalism kind of writing music reviews, and I'm about to launch another podcast that is a culture podcast, which is about film, music and television. And I love doing that so much more than I like thinking and writing about race. But I just need to get it out of it. I just need to do this. I think I need to, these disparate thoughts, the ideas that I have, the fights that I have, the experiences that I've had, I want to condense it. I want to put it in something that I hope is compelling and opens people's minds a little bit and helps them understand why I'm motivated to do what I do, and put it there and say, these are all my thoughts on this stuff. You can go and read it and then, I don't know, write a biography about Kanye West or something like that.
And what do you hope that the readers will take from it, apart from understanding you a little more? Like, what do you think they will...
Yeah, the main sort of thesis behind it is a thing that, again, a lot of Australians find really confronting is I think, and the research that I've done, the people that I've spoken to, the ideas that I'm building on, is that out of comparable sort of developed Western nations that were founded on, you know, genocide and colonial, Australia was and remains the most racist country. I think there are a lot of people in Australia that consume media from the United States, and they're aware of racial injustice there, and they think, God, thank God Australia isn't that bad. And politicians in Australia say you don't need to import those kinds of campaigns of Black Lives Matter into this country. And I think it's a shame that I think probably more Australians would be aware of the over-representation in the prison system of Black Americans, but don't understand that Aboriginal people in Australia are overrepresented at an even worse rate, and that with the conviction of Derek Chauvin for murdering George Floyd last year, despite the hundreds of deaths in custody in Australia, no police officer has ever been convicted in this country. And so, as broken as the United States is, it's a hard thing for people to understand this. It's a deeply broken country with a lot of racial injustice and a lot of inequality issues. We're worse. And that's what I want people to understand with the book.
And Senator, your book, you described to me backstage as like part memoir and part manifesto. And like, we're all buying the book in July, so not too many spoilers, but can you give us a glimpse of what that manifesto is and what your vision for justice is?
So I guess in some ways similar motivations to Oz, but whenever I thought about writing a book, I always felt that it was a very indulgent thing to do, like it was superfluous, like who would want to really read my story, or what could I put into a debate that would be interesting. And then the more I thought about it, the more I think, well, that's exactly the point. Like, I am part and parcel fabric of this country, and voices of brown migrant Muslim women are hardly heard. And so I guess they should be heard and their stories should be told. And I have the wonderful Jane Paul Freeman from Allen and Unwin to thank for that, because I would never have written a book unless she had, she contacted me and encouraged me to do it. But it is the story of my experiences in Pakistan, here, in politics, and hopefully it's going to be kind of a look into Australian politics and racism and feminism, or rather sexism, from an outsider's point of view. Because I proudly consider myself an outsider in politics, at least. So I didn't come through the networks that politicians come through, whether it was union ranks or political staffers or anything like that. And I want more people to be in politics like that. It is also a book about hope. And it is also a book about environmentalism. But it is fundamentally, I think, it talks about discrimination and the struggles of people like me in this country.
What's it called?
It's called Too Migrant, Too Muslim, Too Loud. And these are labels that I am criticized for.
Like the numbers, like in the Too Fast, Too Furious? Or
like T-002, that I'm too migrant for some, too Muslim for some, and too loud for some. But I proudly reclaim those labels.
Could you have the sequel as like too Muslim, too loud, too. It doesn't matter.
Well, I didn't quite think of that, but that could work.
too Muslim Tokyo Drift.
All right. And so we'll do questions for a couple of minutes, and then I'm going to come back and we'll finish with me asking you what your one favourite thing is about the other person.
Sure.
So that's the plan from here. Does anyone have a question?
Thank you very much, the three of you, for an engaging talk and discussion, really. So I'm Jeev. I'm a person of Indian origin, so I want to ask that question about race or politics, because we can talk privately about that. Sure. In Hindustani, I think. So my question is about, I was quite actually interested to know, Marion, your answer about when Young Oz asked you why there's a pay gap between an engineer and the labor working for you. I was curious. I was going to think that probably you got an answer, but probably you escaped that answer. You tried not to do that.
Could you do that, picking that up? Yeah, what was your answer?
Bring it up. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. I've got to think back and think, what is that answer? But I thought that was an incredible question to ask, and a very fair question to ask. And there shouldn't be a pay gap between a person who works so hard and another one who might be working similarly hard only because one has a university degree and the other doesn't. And look at what's happening in our country at the moment, you know, how, you know, more and more there is an increasing pay gap between professions we deem, you know, to be respectable or should be paid more, and ones that we don't. And often the ones that we don't have migrant workers in those. They have become more and more casualized. You know, they have become more and more insecure. So I think that's a really debatable issue to talk about. And I don't think we should have those pay gaps. Like, look at the billionaires. I don't think we should have billionaires in this world. I don't think there's any justification for billionaires in this world. So, yeah, and, you know, like I said, Omar and I often used to, when Oz was young, we used to kind of look at each other and think, God, what have we created?
Because of a billionaire? Or?
No. I hope you never become one.
Thank you. Over here.
Thank you to both of you. My question was, the comments you made about politics and the aggression and the bullying that is part of that, and also sort of personally, I observe the people I know personally have gone into politics seem to have sort of moved away from the reasons why they went into it and have sort of gamified it. So it doesn't look like a very attractive proposition to a lot of us. So thank you, because I don't think that second comment applies to you at all. But what can we do if we're not prepared to put ourselves out there, if we don't feel comfortable with the level of sort of bullying, both, I think, if you take a big public profile or if you go into politics, what can people like us do to make Australia a better place?
Mm, really good question. What do you reckon?
Well, I think we can kick the Liberals out for one at the next election. Let's do that as a start. But I think the word that you use, gamified, it's so much aligns with what I think and what politicians generally talk about, the game of politics. It's not a bloody game. You know, these are people's lives that we make decisions about, but that's all it's become. And the game is about winning the next election, winning our seat back so that we can have that career in politics. So I think, I mean, after all, we still are a representative democracy, though not a very much a participatory democracy. You still have the power to vote. And that is a very powerful thing. And so use that to make sure that we put people in there who don't think of it as a game, who are not career politicians, but also support others who you think should be representing you.
I have one other very quick thing to add. I think Mum made this point before about how in Australia, people don't like to talk about politics, and that was very different for Pakistan. I think that's so true. I think Australians think that it's like, I think it's because the stakes are different. You know, in a country where there's coups and violence, everyone's forced to participate. I think our lack of participation is a reflection of the relative privilege many of us have. And this might sound like such a nothing answer, but participating in things like this, having conversations with people, reading books that are provoking, attending dialogues and doing that in your groups with your families and friends, and pushing back at the Christmas dinners when the uncle's, you know, saying something, right? Like, that stuff is always awkward and weird, but that's what I was trying to allude to before. Like, you can vote. How do you change someone's mind? Talk to them about this stuff. And I think if Australians did that more, we'd be a much better off country.
It's those conversations that will change the world, really are.
one to three words, your favourite thing about the other person.
It's very easy for me. Food. The best food in the world.
Food.
And also right now, the fact that you stopped asking me when I'm getting married. I'm very happy with that.
It's very easy for me as well. It's Oz's courage to go where I don't even go and say things which are needed to be said and not really worrying about the consequences, Oz. I love you so much for that. Oh. You're amazing.
Do you want to revise food? Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.